Up next on the stream of free radio at freakradio.org, we have Bathrop Spears Broadsides for the 10th. That's December 10th, 2020, with interviews with Christine Jacobs, J.C. Orton, and other people that you may have heard of who chatted about at the Huff meeting yesterday. So stay tuned. You'll pick up a few bits of information, at least I did when I was there, and maybe you'll be better for it.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
So yesterday was the 22nd Annual Homelessness Marathon. Jeremy Alderson has been doing that for, I guess, 22 years. It was only 4 hours long yesterday, but it did get a netcast on this station at freakradio.org, and it isn't available as an archive on the Huff Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom website, which is where these shows are generally archived, but it probably will be available on the Homelessness Marathon, that's homelessnessmarathon.org website, one of these days. I don't have any exact predictions. If you want to get a sense of what the kind of broadcasting they do, there is a whole series of their archives. There's the 18th one from 2016, probably all 13 hours of it. The 16th one on 2013. The 18th was on 2016. The 16th was on 2013. And their earlier ones as well, which I participated in some of those, actually. But I didn't participate in this one except to make sure that it got broadcast. And you can go back to some of the really early ones that are available. And hopefully, maybe they'll all be available someday. But a lot of voices from a lot of places in the country. You might want to check out some of the earlier broadcasts. And also, I think eventually the current one is going to be available later. At least I'm hoping it will be. So let's jump right into this interview, which I just did earlier this afternoon when this show is being put together before the 6 o'clock showtime when it's played on the net. It's kind of self-explanatory. It has to do with a woman who filed a complaint against the Santa Cruz Police Department and was very dissatisfied with how she was treated. We're going to let her explain it in her own words with her own emotions. And, well, here's the interview. So today is December 9th, 2020. I'm on the line with Christy Elizabeth Jacobs, according to the claim form you filled out. Do I call you Christine, or what do I call you?
Yeah.
So, Christine,
that's
I'm...
That's fine.
Say again?
That's fine.
Okay. Yeah, I'm Robert Norris, and this is a Free Radio on the Net interview that I'm going to be playing today. The reason that you came to my attention was I saw you were mentioned briefly in a reference in the city council agenda, but they didn't really say other than a vague statement about what happened to you. I then sent an email to the city clerk asking that she make it clear what your actual complaint form was, that is to say, to show it to me. She didn't do that. Instead,
I had no idea, but I happened to hear you, not during the closed sessions open interval, which is where people usually talk about their claims against the city, though they often don't tell you this, or at least I know it can be a little bit confusing. Did you speak earlier about the city council issue, the claim that you had, or did you do it? I think you did it later in the actual agenda. Wasn't that right?
I was only given 2 minutes to speak, and they couldn't continue speaking.
Yeah, and you mentioned also they were cutting you off, and I want to hear about that. But usually, and this is for you and others listening, before the city council meeting has its formal beginning, they have a meeting before the meeting called the closed session. And at the closed session, right before the closed session, which they keep behind closed doors, they have to have an open interval where they allow the public to speak about issues coming up on the closed agenda, even though they can't be present to hear what the council says in closed doors. And those have to do with, personnel matters and also claims against the city. And one of the claims was yours in this last council meeting. And what I was wondering what it was, but I didn't get to the closed session because I didn't. Of course, nobody gets to these sessions because they're all held on Zoom. And as you were mentioning earlier, before we began this conversation, it's really hard to get in there. You keep getting cut off. Some of it, I think, is equipment. Some of it may be intentional. You were suggesting may have been intentional. I don't know. But I know they can be very difficult, and it's the instructions can be very confusing. And the time allowed for you to speak, as you mentioned, 2 minutes, is very, very limited. So I'm going to read what you wrote on your claim form, which is that this was an injury that happened to you on Fern Street in Santa Cruz. A police officer wrongfully stopped you, injured you at a routine traffic stop. You got out of your vehicle. You were afraid for your dog. He was upset. And then it's a little hard to read this. Why don't you kind of run me by what happened?
Okay, well, he didn't tell me. First of all, some woman had road rage. I was trying to turn under Fern. I live in Watsonville. I don't come to Santa Cruz very often out of reason stuff like this going on. I am Hispanic American and Native American, and I feel I was treated prejudiced, number one. Number two, he was threatening me, threatening to harm my pet. And there was no excuse for it because the woman started the whole thing on the other side of the road, the opposite side of the road. She was honking at me and cussing me out and saying all kinds of profanities. And all I did was throw my hands up and say, "What did I do to you?" Well, apparently I was a criminal, so I took a second to stop in the middle of the keep clear, which she was already veering over with her two front tires. So I proceeded to go on the Fern Street. Here he comes up behind me in an unmarked car. Woo! Pull over! Pull over! Going all psycho on me. I said, "What did I do?" He refused to tell me what I did. So I refused to cooperate with him. And I said, "Look, man, you're not telling me why you're pulling me over. Then I don't have to listen." I put the window up. He was banging at my window. He was frightening my animal. My dog's a rescue. He's real nervous. He was frightening my dog, so I refused to do what he wanted. He started hollering at me. We're blocking a driveway in front of someone was trying to get out. It was a delivery. So I just moved my car about maybe 2 feet, maybe 3 feet ahead. He started threatening me, saying I ran from him. You know, he was just totally out of control. It was like if I had my 25-year-old on drugs attacking me, okay? I got out of the car, which was, I guess, a big mistake, apparently. I stepped out of the car. Now, keep in mind, I've got a bad foot, so I couldn't have hurt him if my life depended on it. I got out of the car, and I was upset. I was argumentative. I was mad because I feel like they don't get the criminals to kill people, but they'll get people like me to know where I live. So I got out of the car. And I was trying to be okay with him, and he just started roughing me up, and, "You're going to jail. You're being arrested." And I'm like, "But my foot is hurt." Like, he didn't want to listen to me. And then all the windows got put down in my car. I don't know how that happened. I was fearing for my dog jumping out of my car into the traffic. And I was telling him, "Can you please put my windows up?" "No, no, no. You're in trouble. Shut up. Shut up. You disobeyed me. You didn't obey me. You're going to be sorry. I'm going to teach you. I'm going to teach you." And he was going all berserk on me. And I couldn't, he got me, he threw me around, slammed me on the sidewalk, and handcuffed my hands so damn tight, I couldn't feel my hands the whole time I was sitting there on the ground. Meanwhile, I was freaking out about my pet because he was able to jump out into the traffic, and so it was a big old chaotic mess. said that they all come out, they bring like four or five backup, and they said, because I was talking loud, well, I can't hear well, so I talk loud. I said, so now you're telling me it's a crime to speak loud. And they said, oh, no, no. And then I went directly after he finally let me go. He kept saying I was going to jail. He was going to impound my dog. He was going to do this and that to my dog. He was threatening my dog. My dog was in danger. He wouldn't put the windows up for me. He had my keys in my car. He never would tell me what he was charging me with this whole time, which is really aggressive and out of control, real violent acted toward me. So I started getting angry, and I said some choice words, I'm sure, I was upset. He hurt my foot more, and he messed up my wrist. I got a sprained wrist. And so I was furious. I mean, you know, here I was feeling sorry for these cops a few weeks ago. Well, that's not happening ever again. So anyhow, all my mail was flying out of my window. It was a windy day. All my Social Security, all my stuff got compromised. It flew down the street. I never found it. I went back. I never found it. He bring all this backup to try to keep me there, and they were like just looking at him. And my sunglasses had fell down off my face, and I asked him if he could pick them. He was telling me no. He was just being awful to me. So then the one of the police officers came and put my glasses back on. He's all, ma'am, it's okay. Just sit down, ma'am. You know, he's a nice young kid. They were training. Anyhow, long story short, I got jacked up by them. I got injured by him. Nothing was done to him. They're still sticking the ticket on me. Well, no, wait. He couldn't figure out what he was getting me for. I apologize. Let me go back. I'm so furious about it. He couldn't figure out what he was getting me for. He got me for honking my horn too loud, for running from him. And then about 3 weeks later, he sent me a ticket. He corrected saying that I refused to show ID.
Now, let me interrupt you, Christy, because I want to ask Christine, because this happened all, you know, in mid-June.
November.
Right, November.
The 9th.
Yeah, I beg you, November 9th. That's correct. I'm seeing that now on the claim form. How many police officers eventually came into this scene?
About seven.
And how many squad cars did you count?
Three. Four.
And did you notice the names of any of these cops?
No, he refused to get another thing. I asked him for his badge number and a card. He refused to identify himself. He refused to tell me what he pulled me over for. He couldn't figure out what he pulled me over. He had me right there in my hands, so tight I couldn't feel my hands. He was looking through a little code book trying to bust me. He couldn't even find what he was getting me for. And I feel like he did it to me because I'm female, I'm Hispanic, and I think he was scared of me because I was taller than him, and I had a loud voice that I can't hear. He was trying, and he told me I was going to be sorry. He said he was going to teach me a lesson.
Now, let me ask you.
Let me ask you,
Christine. How long did all this take?
Probably almost an hour, 45 minutes. My hands were hurting, so my hands are still hurting.
How long were your hands held in handcuffs?
I don't even know. To be honest with you, I have no idea. It was like the longest hour of my life. I really don't know. All that was going through my mind was my dog was going to jump out of the car and get killed and hurt my kids.
Gotcha.
We just got that dog, and he's a rescue.
Gotcha.
Nervous. I feared for his safety because he was threatening him.
Right. Let me ask you this. Was there much of a crowd of people watching?
You know, to be honest with you, I was so upset. I didn't even notice. I know the fellow that we were walking his gate. He's all, hey, man, can you move out of the way? And so I just unknowingly, just being a normal person, moved forward.
So you said, yeah, I understand. Yeah, you mentioned that. Did he stay around to watch, as far as you know, or not?
Well, I don't know. To be honest, I really don't know. This all happened so fast.
I understand.
Caught off guard. I really don't remember.
I understand. I noticed also, and when I finally did get, later after the city council meeting, the city clerk did send me your original claim form, which is what I'm looking at now as I'm talking to you. And you also included a copy of a statement from the hospital that you were injured. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, and I also got a thing from the DMV. He tried to make me do this. I was telling you, he tried to make me lose my driver's license. He turned me into the DMV, saying I was a dangerous driver. The DMV sent me a letter. They let me go. They said that there was no charges on me. He was trying to make it where I lose my driving privileges because he said I disobeyed him. Mm-hmm. I was going to be sorry.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's
what. One more thing I want to throw up, if I can hear this too. Yeah, you guys are going to be shocked with this. When his, I, department to go make a complaint against.
Now, what happened? And what happened there when you? How long after did you go to the department?
It took. I went straight there. I was furious. I didn't even know where to go. I looked up on Google. I got over there. I sat there for a good 40, 50 minutes for them to come out and talk to me. His boss come out, and you guys are going to be appalled at what he said.
Christine, who did you talk to there? Do you know?
You know, I don't even remember. It happened. I was so furious. He come out, and he goes, "Ma'am, I just want to let you know that we're having a hard time right now with this election going on that just happened and this pandemic and stuff. People aren't thinking clear." And I'm all, "That's an excuse. You guys have been trained up the yin-yang, properly trained on how to deal with people that are out of control. And that stupid kid would have just said to me, 'Ma'am, I'm pulling you over because of this. Can you give me your license?' I would have cooperated." It's the way he came at me like one of those people on the side of the road, all violent, you know, going off of me. And I'm a Christian person. I don't usually get so mad, but what got me so mad was here I was feeling sorry for these people, you know, thinking, "Oh, people shouldn't be so mean to the cops or whatever." Well, you know what? I'm sorry to say they deserve it now.
So, let me calm you down here. Christine, let me calm you down a bit here by saying that, and this is advice I would give to you and anybody listening who gets into these kinds of situations. It's, you know, it's really hard to deal with when you're on the highway and you're facing an armed individual with the authority of a whole police department and, you know, a weapon at his side. You know, and you're alone, and you're in your own vehicle, so it can be difficult.
Well, I was afraid of him. I was for my dog.
Right, it's difficult. Anyone would be, I think. It's natural, and that's one of the concerns that those of us who are concerned about police department abuses, you know, are worried about. But something to remember for other people, I think, is if you ever, for example, if you ever go to make a complaint. One, try if you can, bring a recording device with you. If you got any recorder or a phone that records, and record what you say and what the other officer says to you. You can do that if a police...
I didn't have my phone. He wouldn't let me get my phone. He had me totally trapped right there. I was helpless. I had no help.
Right.
He wouldn't let me help my dog.
What I recommend, Christine, in that situation, and again, you know, you can never second guess it really, because, you know, it's a really difficult situation for you and for anyone else in that situation, but you know immediately when you're pulling over, when a police officer comes up to you, get your phone out and do so. So I say, "I'm getting my phone,
my
officer."
My son was telling me the same day I should have got my phone out. But you know what's funny? I was trying to reach my phone and he took my keys away from me. He wanted to make damn sure that I didn't run away. And that's so stupid. I was limping.
Right, so that I would say that in order, you definitely want to, you know, if you can get access to a recording device. Another thing is, if you're going to make a complaint, and you're, you know, because by that time, although you were very pissed, but, you know, you might have, you know, if you waited a day and you were calmer, or even if you weren't, it's always good to bring a witness with you. That's another thing you might consider doing if any of this ever happens to you or anyone listening again.
Mm-hmm.
Because often, you know, you get rattled. I mean, you're upset, you're angry, you feel like you...
Dude, I couldn't believe it. I was so shook up.
That's why you need another person with you to have that happen. And
I was just going to get gas at Costco.
A recording device is also a good thing to do, particularly, you know, when you go to the police station. It's good to have that with you. And, you know, because remember, I mean, even your situation is, you know, you don't normally, you know, have a lot of these confrontations with police, I imagine. And that being the case, you know, you don't really...
I didn't want to fight with him.
Whereas police officers always sort of have this training. They train on how to control the conversation, which is kind of what I'm trying to do right now.
I don't think he had trained or he didn't.
I'm not saying they're trained well, but I'm saying that because they have that kind of training and you don't, you often can be, they can push your buttons, and of course it sounds like his buttons.
Well, you know, that's funny, because I was
too.
Going to a psychology class for child care, and they had cops in there that were training them how to deal with people in the public. It qualified as training for the police, so I know there's no excuse for that guy.
I'm not trying to excuse him. What I'm saying is, I'm looking for ways for people to deal with the police, because, you know, the police are going to do what they're going to do. Our problems as members of the community, when we have to deal with police, is to have an effective way of dealing with it, so that later on we can hold them accountable if we can. I mean, you're trying to hold the officer accountable, and the first thing you got to do, of course, is try to remember who the officer was, and ask the officer. and get that kind of information that you need. But if you don't get it, you still have access to it. I mean, you still can probably find out the name of the officer who did this to you. And what I would do if I were you is I would send an email to the police department stating, you know, on November 9th, 2020, on Fern Street, I was stopped. I was approached by a police officer in an incident that I need some information about. You can put it very neutrally
if you want. You know, even though you're really
they
pissed.
Part of safety is why they didn't want to give his information out.
What you then do is you send this request to the police department, and you start getting a paper trail. The police department may not respond. They may treat you like shit. They may ignore you. But the fact of the matter is, if you are making these requests, you have a record that you are behaving in a reasonable, calm, or even pissed way, but you are making requests that are intelligible, that are, you know, that are fair, and you're not getting responses. So that's the kind of advice I have. You then, of course, tried to talk about this at City Council, and, you know, describe what happened there.
Well, I kept trying to call, like, send me a letter and told me my case would be decided on this meeting of the City Council, which is bullshit. They didn't even hear the whole story, and it's ridiculous because they went over there and gave me this code to call in. I called when they said. They said I was locked out of the meeting, and I kept calling the whatever that number was to get a hold of. She goes, well, you're out, ma'am. Sorry. They're going to make a decision against you. And then I kept calling. I was like, hell no, I'm going to keep calling. I kept calling. I finally got in. I waited on the phone for almost 2.5 hours for the whole boring meeting. And then it said by a certain time when they were going to end an event or agenda that needed to be heard, you can press number 9 and then unmute you. So I waited on the phone from like 1 o'clock to almost 3:45 or whatever, and I finally got in. And I didn't get to say the whole story.
Right, although, Christine, is interesting, because you called in, in a way, although I got no sympathy for the mayor anyway, because I don't like what he does generally, and I don't like the way he runs the meetings. But you were trying to get in. They will always claim, even if their equipment fucks up, you were trying to get in late. Well, it's your fault, not our fault, or we have to go ahead, or we're too busy, or whatever. But he let you in for 2 minutes, which of course didn't give you enough time anyway. That was the amount of time they would have given you if you'd gotten in at the beginning. They don't let you talk for more than 2 minutes. You see, they routinely deny these claims because unless you have an attorney to back you, or unless you have a lot of legal savvy yourself, you know, and also you've got other things to do than spend your time tussling around with the city where these guys get paid to fuck with you. You know, they get paid to, you know, and other people get paid to defend what they do. So it's a whole nasty system. It's a whole hierarchy that is kind of it's rigged against you from the beginning. If you'll forgive me for saying this.
No, it is. I know. That's why I was like, man, I couldn't believe it. Like, I mean, if I would have been doing something like threatening that woman or being, I threw my hands up and said, "What did I do to you?" I didn't even cuss at this woman. Like, it was ridiculous. I'm telling you, I really think it was a race thing. I'm part white, I'm part Mexican, I'm both. You can't say I'd be a prejudice about nobody, okay? But that lady was white, and that cop was white, and he was trying to attack me. And he said, what did he say to me? He said, all he kept saying over, I didn't obey him. I was going to obey. He was going to make me learn, he kept saying. Now, I don't think that's normal when the police would talk to someone in a routine traffic stop.
You know, it's interesting that you say that because I think that even if that's not what they say, that's what they think. And when they're thinking that, they may put it in the very nicest of terms, but they can also whip out their gun and shoot you when things get too hot for them. And the ultimate motivation is not because you're a real threat, but because you are not obeying. Because obedience
is, exactly.
I mean, they may not say it, but I think that's the text underneath, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, and then my dog, he protects me so good, and he was trying to attack him because he's seen him trying to harm me, and thank God he didn't hurt the dog. You know, that dog's been through so much, and he was so upset, and he's such a jerk. You know what really made me so upset the most? He could have rolled up my windows, and, you know what I'm saying, and he scratched it in my car, and he threw my key
police officers concerned about this? Did they seem to say anything, or what was your reaction?
No, one of them was kind enough to go put my windows up. The young guy they were training, he was kind enough to put my glasses up on my face when someone's blinding me. And he put, you know, don't worry, man, your dog's okay. I put the windows up. But, you know, the way I see this officer, and he wouldn't give me his real name. They told me his name was Care or something like that. Okay, if this guy was really such a good cop and concerned, like he said, when I told him I was hurt, he should listen. It's like he wanted to hurt my foot more and try to punish me why I didn't bow down to him. That's how I took it.
Now,
he wanted me to bow down to him.
Did any of the other officers give you their cards or offer information about who they were?
He gave me nothing. He handed me for a ticket with a bunch of charges on it. He didn't even know himself what they were for. He was there for like 15 minutes with his little code book, looking up codes to get me.
Now, the ticket that you have, Christine, does it have the officer's name legibly? Can you read it?
No, I cannot legibly read it. No, I cannot.
I gotcha. Well, Well, listen, I thank you for running this by me. Is there more you want to add? I mean, you pretty much covered it, and you've emphasized a number of things.
You know what I do want to add? I want to add, and I hope the police listens to this, hears it. You know, they would get a lot farther if they would really try their best to be kind to people. Because, again, if he would have just approached me more calm and collected like he should have been, I would have been more than willing to hear him out. But it was his pride, his haughty, cocky, I'm going to punk you out, bitch, type of attitude that started fear in me that I haven't had in 20 years. I was peacefully listening to my church show on the radio. I wasn't doing nothing to him, but he caught me off guard. And what got me most angry was he endangered my pet and myself. All because of road rage. I wasn't the one doing that road rage. He didn't even, he was behind her. Like, I don't know how he didn't see her doing all this stuff to me. And I think it's a case of prejudice because she was in a Mercedes, she was fancy, she was all bad. I looked like the homeless old Mexican in my van. But I'm not all Mexican, I'm white too. So all I ever bring is my mom's white and my dad's Mexican. So
this whole, Christine, this whole incident began because of an exchange between you and this woman in the other car?
Yes, and it wasn't even my doing. I threw my hands up and said, what did I do to you? And I went beep, beep, and I honked back at her. She was laying on her horn. She was laying on her horn.
Now, did the police officer talk to her?
Nope, he let her go and chased after me.
Wow. Well, look. Let me pass this on because I think we've covered this. If you want to hear this show, I think I have your email here. I'm looking at it. I think I have it. Jacobs Christian Oz and so forth. That's
no. I have Jacobs Christine 02 in Gmail. And just to let you guys know, I talk loud, but I don't hear good.
No, I understand. I understand. You said that, and I appreciate that.
The reason why he called backup was he felt afraid.
No, I remember you said that. You're good. No, I mean, yeah, I think you've made that clear. And if you want, I can put you on the this group I work with, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. I can put you on our email list so you get our notices about what's happening. We meet once a week if you're interested. And of course, you're in Watsonville, so that's a ways away. But
I'd like to get involved. I think they really abused their authority. There you go.
Well, I will send you this. I'll put you on the Huff email list, and I'm going to stop the recording here and thank you for taking the time to talk to me.
And that was my conversation with Christine Jacobs earlier this afternoon. Maybe playing a little of what she said to City Council. And a little of what I said to City Council, but I think that, if it does happen at all, is likely to happen in the longer Sunday show. We have a limited time here, and let's go into our musical moments. And so, as I occasionally do, here's the lyrics, since it's kind of hard to hear the parody project, Don Caron, doing his rendition. The orange demon went to Georgia and his patience was wearing thin. He was telling lies as a faint disguise for the trouble he's been in. He lost an important contest and he still claims he can win. And now he's got receipts for some Senate seats and he wants to cash them in. The demon focused on himself and he tried to swing a deal when he said, "Hey, Kemp, you pathetic wimp, There's some votes you need to steal. But Kemp refused to do it. He had visions of parole, and he didn't see an ascendancy because he'd already sold his soul. George Demon's done his stuff before. Will it work? Well, it's hard to tell. What he's all about might be played out because his game has gone to hell. Georgia is evolving from the ways of the old South when thinly veiled white racist rhetoric spewed forth from their mouths. They're younger and more racially diverse than ere before, and if they win the South, we'll hear their roar. On one side, Ossoff and Warnock, who want to help people out. On the other, Loeffler and Perdue. Let me tell you what they're about. Loeffler's got priorities, protecting her 800 mil. She's out of touch and she doesn't care much, just making money on the Hill. Perdue's not unfamiliar with the smell of a crooked deal. There was money made from a COVID aid that he's anxious to conceal. The orange one claims election fraud. His cult repeats and applauds. The people need to take control of the battleground for the country's soul. Republicans got a strategy to simply lie and smear, painting wild imagery of scary radicals to fear. But there's a power loose in Georgia we ain't seen down there before, and those good old boys with their golden toys should be looking for the door. Georgia's evolving from his place in the old South when thinly veiled white racist rhetoric came from their mouth. They're younger and more racially diverse than e'er before, and if they win, the South will hear their roar.
Demon went to Georgia, and his patience was worn thin. He was telling lies as a faint disguise for the trouble he's been in. He lost an important contest, and he still claims he can win. And now he's got receipts for some sentences, and he wants to cash them in. The demon focused on himself and tried to swing a deal. When he said, "Hey, Kemp, the pathetic wimp, there's some votes you need to steal." But Kemp refused to do it. He had visions of parole, and he didn't see an ascendancy because he'd already sold his soul. The Orange Demon's tried this crap before, but workable is hard to tell. What he's all about might be played out because his game has gone to hell.
Georgia's evolving from the ways of the old South. When thinly veiled white racist rhetoric spewed from their mouths. They're younger and more racially diverse than ever before. And if they win the South, we'll hear their roar.
Is Warnock and Ossoff, and they want to help people out. On the other, Loeffler and Perdue, let me tell you what they're about. Loeffler's got priorities, protecting her 800 mil. She's out of touch and she doesn't care much, she's making money on the Hill. Perdue's not unfamiliar with the smell of a crooked deal. There was money made from the COVID aid that he's anxious to conceal.
The Arkham claims election fraud. His hope would be said and the plots.
The Republicans got a strategy to simply lie and smear. Fake wild imagery of scary radicals to fear. But there's a power loose in Georgia we ain't seen down there before. And those good old boys with their golden toys should be looking for the door.
Georgia is evolving from the ways of the old South. When thinly veiled white racist rhetoric spewed from their mouths. They're younger and more racially diverse than ever before. And if they win the South, we'll hear their roar.
Next up, here is a short cut from Kim Brown's Burn It Down, which you can find on YouTube. Just go to Burn It Down YouTube, or you can try The Real News, where the show also appears, about a couple of things. Seattle police lessening of police funding, though not defunding, and police, what may be police murder or assassination in Los Angeles. Here's a little of that.
Today's program is titled, "Was Andres Guardado the target of a police gang initiation. And if you've been watching Burn It Down, even our predecessor to Burn It Down, Stir Crazy, you know that we've been covering that case of the 18-year-old security guard working in Compton, California, ended up with 5 bullets in his back from allegedly the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. And then the situation has gone completely left. We heard from the whistleblower over the summer who claimed that Andres was killed as part of a police gang initiation. Well, there has been additional developments with this story. We're going to get updated and catch you all the way up on that. Listen, y'all, cops are leaving the country. Cops are pleading the fifth. It is very uncertain right now whether or not any justice will be served for Andres's family. So we're going to get updated on that very shortly. And for reasons why the police should be defunded. Well, like I said, look no further than the case of Andres Guardado right there. But in Seattle, Washington, the Seattle City Council voted to defund the police. No, like seriously, by 20%. And this is a significant amount. At the same time, activists are not necessarily claiming victory because they were seeking a 50% cut to the Seattle police budget. And I'm very excited to be joined coming up a little later in the show with Seattle City Councilwoman Shama Savant. She's going to join us and tell us why she voted against the 20% cut to defund the police, which to me is amazing. Trust me, if you told people in Baltimore, Maryland right now that the Baltimore Police Department was going to get their budget cut by 20%, people would start dancing in the streets. But Seattle says that's not good enough. And I respect that, to be quite honest. So I'm looking forward to that conversation. But like I said at the top of the program, the case of 18-year-old Andres Guardado, who tragically was shot in the back by Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department officers. And Dwayne, if we could, I want us to go to, I believe it was V1, where in the immediate aftermath of the shooting of Mr. Guardado, journalist Memo Torres was on the scene and interviewing the store owner of the shop where Andres was working at the time he was killed by cops. Let's take a look at that video if we could. This is from June.
He was standing right there at that curb where the fire hydrant is, and he was talking to two girls, and then the police approached him and right away drew their guns, pointed them at him, and he got scared and he ran in here, and then he ended up getting on his knees with his hands behind his head. And then the cop shot him 7 times.
That is just a horrifying account there by, I believe it is the shop owner where Andres was working security. And in the days following, you know, the community took to the streets to protest the murder of this young man. And they, in turn, were met by more violence from Los Angeles Police Department out there. Dwayne, let's take a look at V2 if we could.
Demonstrators face off with deputies in Compton as a peaceful protest takes a violent turn.
They opened fire and they started throwing rubber shots at people. People were protesting peacefully. They decided to attack them and drop a bomb on them and also tear gas.
Protesters capturing the chaos on camera. The trouble began when deputies fired pepper balls at several protesters, demonstrators then taking aim with water bottles and debris.
And then all of a sudden we hear shots coming out, people started running in different directions, but they made a huge mistake because, let's not forget, the whole world knows Compton.
What do we want?
Justice!
When do we want it?
Justice!
The peaceful protest began at the scene of Thursday's deadly deputy-involved shooting. Authorities say Andres Guardado pulled out a gun when confronted by deputies. The 18-year-old shot 6 times.
When will the violence end? It's who's next? Am I next?
Guardado's family says he was shot in the back as he ran from deputies and are insisting he did not own a gun. His father joining today's march to demand justice and an end to police brutality.
I say thank you, everybody, for coming here. You know, I'm feeling very bad to talk, you know, because I'm feeling really good, you know.
Those turning out today say the 18-year-old's death is just the latest in a long history of lives lost at the hands of law enforcement.
Maybe now everyone can see that new training is required
And the defund the police really means let's create an organization that is really for peace.
That video there, courtesy of ABC7 out in Los Angeles. We are joined today with journalist Memo Torres. Memo, I appreciate you being here because you have been following this case really since it happened back in June. Gosh, 6 months ago now, Andres was murdered. First of all, thank you so much for making the time to be with us.
Thank you for having me. It's a great pleasure, and I'm glad to talk about this, and I'm glad you're bringing light to this issue.
Okay, so to ask you what has changed in 6 months, I think is probably an extremely loaded question because a lot has changed. Some of the accounting that we heard in that video there from ABC7, some of that has been debunked. I don't believe police ever found a gun on Andres. And well, let's just start there. What is the status of the investigation now as it stands?
You showed earlier the clip I had of Andrew Haney. He was actually the shop manager. He wasn't the shop owner. A lot of people get that confused. But he's been gone missing. He's one of the main witnesses, and nobody can track him down. The police or the lawyers, the coroner's office haven't been able to find him. Currently, what we just had last week was one of the first inquests in 40 years. It's an inquest that was called by the coroner, which is similar to a trial, except they're not looking for fault. They're looking for evidence. They're trying to find facts as to what exactly happened that moment up to Andres Guardado's being killed and shot in the back. And that inquest, I was there. I because I took that video and spoke to Andrew Haney, I was there for that inquest to testify that I did speak with Andrew Haney, and that I did take that video so they could submit that as evidence. And that inquest was crazy. I think Miguel Vega, the deputy Miguel Vega, and Chris Hernandez, who were the deputies on site. Miguel Vega was the deputy who shot Andres Guardado in the back. He was out of the country, so he didn't present himself. He was going to submit a declaration where he claimed he invoked the Fifth. Chris Hernandez, the other deputy, his partner, was there at the scene, also invoked the Fifth. And that's kind of expected, but was even crazier is that the investigators that were on site, Mike Davis and Joseph Valencia, also invoked the Fifth. They refused to answer any questions about their investigation, even as to what their duties were, who assigned them, how long they've been in the force. I mean, they refused to answer any questions, and that was just mind-blowing. I think that was the biggest bombshell of the inquest so far. But that's where we're at.
Bear repeating. The witness whom you interviewed, the witness to the murder of Andres Guardado, the manager of the store, is not able to be found right now. He has disappeared. Is that right?
Yeah, he can't be located. Nobody knows what happened to him. He might be hiding. That's what we hope. We don't know. I mean, they can't locate him.
That's troubling. Also, yeah. The fact that the police officers who allegedly were the ones shooting Andres and who were present on the scene have also pled the Fifth, which is, I guess, not surprising, but disturbing nonetheless. And we have some video of that. Dwayne, can we key up the video of the officers invoking their Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination? Because why else would you invoke the Fifth unless you were fucking guilty? But let's take a look at that if we could, Dwayne.
Pursuant to the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution, not to answer any questions at this time. Detective Valencia, can you tell us what documents, if any, you reviewed in your preparation for your testimony today? Can you repeat that, please? Yes. Can you please tell us what documents, if any, you reviewed in preparation for your testimony here today? Based on advice of my counsel, I'm currently invoking my rights pursuant to the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution and not to answer any questions at this time. Thank you, Detective Valencia. Is it your intention to claim the privilege against self-incrimination to all the remaining questions on the topic of your occupation?
So, Memo, are these officers who were on the scene and involved in Andres' murder, I would assume that they're all not on the street currently. They're probably on some sort of administrative leave at this point.
No, they're on the street. They're at work. The officer you just showed was actually the investigator, Mike Davis, who was on the site invoking the Fifth. He's the detective supposed to gather the evidence and supposed to, you know, give the evidence over to this inquest, you know, which is trippy because nobody was accusing him of being at fault of anything. And then for him to just say, I plead the Fifth, I'm not going to answer any questions about the investigation, was just like, what the fuck just happened? Yeah. The deputies didn't even show up to court. One of them's out of town. He's on vacation. But they're still working. They don't have behind desk jobs. They're still assigned. I mean, the sheriff does a very good job of protecting his deputies. You know, and he has a tight grip on all the evidence. So, I mean, the reason the inquest happened, the coroner called this inquest, and the last one was 40 years ago, was because even the coroner saw that something was up. I mean, this wasn't right. I mean, they had a second coroner look into it. He confirmed that it was homicide, that Andres Guardado was shot in the back, and they showed the bullet wounds. They showed that one was downward from the middle of his sternum towards his front, which indicated that he was possibly on his knees, and the other four were upward, which means he was already falling or on the ground. When they shot him, and he had two other abrasions. There were 7 shots total, 5 hit. But yeah, that's crazy.
It's stunning. Just the level of protection that police are afforded when they murder an unarmed citizen or a non-citizen, just an unarmed person out here in the streets, basically just doing his job. And the other part of this heartbreaking story has to do with the fact that at least one of these officers has been accused of trying to use perhaps Andres's murder as a method of gaining entry into a Los Angeles Sheriff's Department gang called the Executioners. Some news broke months ago by Spectrum News's, I believe it's Kate Cagle, released some deposition video that I wanted to take a look at. We have been following this story for several months. And when this part about it came out, I was also floored by this as well. Let's check out some of that whistleblower testimony, Dwayne.
How about this latest shooting of Andres Guardado? Was that done by an inked member or a prospect of the Executioners?
Prospect.
And who was that prospect? You know?
Lacks Foundation. Speculation and conjecture on the part of the witness.
Deputy Vega and Deputy Hernandez. And again, this is common knowledge where they'll say they see a person running with a gun, but then there's never a gun recovered. But then, you know, there's also to apprehend that suspect, there's force involved.
Memo, let me get your take on that, because Deputy Vega is the one who has left the country. Is that accurate?
That's correct. Deputy Vega is the one that left the country. It's interesting that Art Gonzalez was saying that, you know, they do chase these people down, they run them down and then say they have a gun. Deputy Miguel Vega has actually been disciplined before for falsifying statements and planting evidence. That's documented too. So you have this history with Miguel Vega already doing these kind of shady things in the neighborhood. And then finding out that he wanted to join the deputy gang, the Executioners, which is just one of many deputy gangs that LA is infested with, is not surprising, I guess, to say. I mean, we all kind of suspected it. I mean, but, you know, to hear that is just it's heartbreaking, you know, like, that they'd rather join a gang, a deputy gang, and murder an 18-year-old kid while he's running away and shoot him in the back for that.
Memo, there's a lot to unpack out of that. You know, I wanted to ask, you know, how do this proliferation of these police gangs, how does that influence the way that they police and the communities that they police?
Oh, they're gangs in every sense of the word. I mean, I don't use that word lightly. In the different publication. I mean, on my Twitter, I have a whole deep dive into different articles about them. They have initiations, which is the executioners, they're called executioners for a reason. I mean, Miguel Vega was trying to execute Andres Guardado. They basically take over different center, different deputy stations, like you have the Banditos in Ixtlé, and they take a stranglehold on the community. They will work with certain gangs. They will fight other gangs with gangs. We had the whole, I mean, it goes back to the Rampart scandal in LA with the crash unit, you know, and then them teaming up with Suge Knight and, you know, fighting the 18th Street to try to get control of like neighborhood drug trafficking and make money off of that. I mean, this is something that's been documented historically, and they cause trouble. They cause trouble. They even have historically fought each other. And these deputy gangs have evolved from the jail system because the sheriffs control the jails. So, you know, you had like the 3000 block boys, the 2000 block boys, you know, and now you have like the Vikings, the Little Devils, the regulators, you know, they see themselves as like cowboys, basically, you know, like this is a real thing, you know, and they terrorize neighborhoods. They do. They go out there and they feel like they own the neighborhoods. And you will hear from people in the community talk about how they literally just terrorize people. You had the case with what was his name? Dalvin Price in Compton. Dalvin Price recently got beat up by one of these police. I mean, just doing nothing. He was just walking down the street. And that was videotaped. And then the city, Compton City Hall, had to go and get the deputies out there. And they had to like do a whole press about it and get the community out there. And it's, I mean, there's just so many details. You recently had the deputy, the sheriffs down in South LA shoot Dijon Kesey, who was on his bike and he was running down the street. And I mean, he was using his bike, and according to sheriffs, they were going to pull him over for a traffic infraction. I guess he didn't make a stop while riding his bike. He saw the police. He ran the same thing as Andres Guardado, shot him in the back. They recovered a gun, you know, according to them. That was another incident. So, I mean, deputy gangs here and the deputy sheriff's deputies have little accountability. They have zero trust from the community, and they literally just terrorize communities at this point.
Have you been in touch with Andres's family? And if so, I mean, how are they doing? What has been their response to all of this? You know, I was talking to a friend about this case, and my friend wondered aloud, you know, whether or not Andres or his family perhaps were undocumented, and perhaps that is part of the reason why this investigation has, you know, just been a farce, really, from the outset, with police now taking the fifth. The main officer who is perhaps implicated has left the country with no.
And one comment about this Fifth Amendment stuff. Fifth Amendment is supposed to be a device to protect you from police abuse and the abuse of authorities in courts, and to stop you from being tortured. The presumption that Kim Brown has, well, you're necessarily guilty if you take the fifth, isn't true. But I think in this case, because it was an investigator who took the fifth, the issue became, was the investigator doing a decent job? Could he be perhaps found guilty of something else that hasn't been charged yet because his investigation was shoddy? And that could be a reason he takes the fifth. Or at least the question then becomes, is there a legitimate basis for Fifth Amendment claims? Are you simply protecting people who are guilty and who should be charged and forced to own up? And one is tempted in listening to this kind of discussion to veer in that direction. But, you know, as an inveterate civil libertarian myself, an individual who believes in this kind of constitutional protection, I don't think it's a good idea to abandon the Fifth Amendment. People can get evidence other than out of an individual's mouth. And the fact that a person doesn't want to talk about an issue doesn't necessarily mean they're guilty. It's like it may bear some parallel with a cop telling you, hey, I want to search you. I want to look in your house. Let me search your house. If you've got nothing to fear, why should you worry about it? The answer can also be an issue of privacy. It could be an issue of that your comments can be construed the wrong way. It can be an issue of that it's none of the business of the person asking, or that it's a fishing expedition. There can be reasons why the Fifth Amendment is appropriate. And I thought I'd just say that because, well, I thought it was worth saying. Back now to Kim Brown talking about this case of Andre Guardado and whether he was killed as part of a sheriff's gang's initiation. By the way, you can hear this entire thing and see more of the video by going on to YouTube and checking it out there. Kim Brown, Burn It Down.
Intends to return. Have you spoken with his family? And if so, what have they said about these latest developments?
I don't have any contact with the family. I had approached them initially when I was taking the video and they were there, but they have been so exhausted of talking to people and just emotionally distraught that I never got a chance to get their information. So I haven't spoken with them myself. I do know other activists and people and lawyers that do speak with them, but I don't know how they're feeling about it right now. I imagine they're, I don't know, angry about the whole situation, to say the least. But what was your other question? I'm sorry.
Well, I guess I'm just curious about, I mean, I can't even say how was the community taking this, because, you know, the list of names of police violence and brutality that you just listed off, tragically, Compton, East LA are very much accustomed to police. I can't even say they're acting rogue, because this is how they act, right? They act like gangsters. They act like they do not have any adherence whatsoever to the Constitution or to people's civil rights. How is this summer, from your perspective, has this summer changed anything? Has it changed the attitudes of people on the ground? I mean, we know that the Block Garcetti protests have been happening daily now for almost 2 weeks, with activists showing up at Eric Garcetti's house, the mayor of Los Angeles, steady. Has there been a shift in the way Los Angelinos are approaching the defund/abolish the police movement?
I think there has been. I think if anything, the police have started showing their colors more. I mean, these are things that, like, the deputy gangs is something that's been documented for a long time, but people don't really, I don't know why it's never gone traction or people really paid attention to it. Maybe because they don't believe it happens, because, you know, you have it in concentrated neighborhoods, you know, and these neighborhoods are like Compton, East LA, and they're not happening in like Santa Monica, Beverly Hills, Culver City. But now you're starting to see, like, you know, a lot of people from these neighborhoods starting to come out too, like West Hollywood. I mean, all over Hollywood, even the Valley, like all these areas in LA, you start seeing more people coming out, which traditionally don't, you know, you don't see them getting involved with any protests. So you do see a lot more faces out there. You do see a lot of more community action, you know, a lot more demands. And the story of the Andres Guardado case is like, it's almost like a can of worms, and they're slowly just crawling out of the can, and people are starting to pay attention. And, like, you know, with this inquest and investigators pleading the Fifth, everybody's like, okay, what is going on? What?
And there's more if you want to check it out at YouTube with Kim Brown's Burn It Down. We'll probably listen in also to a little bit of the Seattle situation and the police defunding vote there. But first, here's a little music.
In a series of astonishing statements today, the president seemed to repeatedly take the Russian leader's side over that of
the U.S. The Washington Post reports this afternoon that a woman is alleging Roy Moore.
President Trump squares up symbolically against Kim Jong-un, saying he's got a personal message.
Whenever I'm just too depressed to deal.
Another tumbling domino rippling through Hollywood.
And the quote-unquote fake news is much too real.
Things are about to get very, very weird.
I exercise the stress inside my brain and take a much-needed panic-induced medicated stroll down memory lane. I miss manageable scandal, the kind that I could handle without a lot of vodka and a Xanax haze. Good old innocent fluff, like that Watergate stuff. Yeah, those were the good old days. I miss Iran-Contra pardons, and presidential hard-ons, when political commotion felt like just a phase, like Barack's disrepute for the wrong colored suit. Ha 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 ha! Those were the good old days. I pour me some tea and then turn on my CNN, at least while my patience will allow.
We have more breaking news.
Yeah, I can't. Remembering the simple things like tax fraud and whiskey rings, and wondering where's Anita Bryant now. I miss her. I miss Hurricane Katrina and Anthony Zawina and that darling girl Kim Davis when she came for gays. Wasn't that cute? Gordon Quayle's potatoes, John F. Kennedy's hose. Yeah, those were the good old days. I'd gladly trade in Jared Kush for just one more bush from those bush.
I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
Old.
I want to apologize to everybody.
Tonight with Donald Trump Jr. and his secret correspondence for months with WikiLeaks before the election.
I miss moderate decorum. Oh, I miss Rick Santorum before all the sleaze and Huckabees and dossiers. I miss Saddam Hussein. I miss Monica Stain. Those were the good old days. I stand in my shower stall, drinking more alcohol, and dream of the good times we forgot.
And
when hope was inside of us, and all that divided us was, did OJ do it or not? Even Mel Gibson seems charming again. I miss her. I miss him too. Aw. I miss Hillary's emailing. I might miss Sarah Palin. Back when all the greatest punchlines were Tina Fey's. Now the punchline's this putz, and the jokes are on us. I miss the good old days. I take a
So now, somewhat in desperation, and somewhat because I think that what we had to say was interesting, here's some bits from yesterday's HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom meeting at the Sub Rosa, which we did outside in the courtyard, as we have been doing for the last, gosh, every week, with a few exceptions. Let's listen in.
All right, so again, this is all potentially going out on the internet because I think it's often the things we talk about are of interest, I think, and not known to the general public that much. These reports that we do don't get into mainstream media or even alternative media, although somewhat on Facebook and elsewhere. So, hence, I'm recording these. If you want to talk about something, you don't want to be recorded for some reason, although I encourage you to be bold, and if you really want to have a private conversation, just go off to the side and do it that way. But, you know, tell me. We'll turn it off while that's happening. This agenda has got three items on it. It's got the agenda, which says actual agenda items. It's got the description of the last two shows, which, in case you're interested, tells you in case you want to figure, if you ever decide to go back online to hear any of those shows, you can do it. It describes the shows. And then the third thing on the back is Keith McHenry's memories of Bob Reese, who died recently. And, well, it's pretty self-explanatory. There's a bit of hubbub on Facebook with Brent and that and all that. Brent's concerned about Food Not Bombs posting shelter alternatives, which I think they've been trying to do, although there isn't a lot of flyers, except for me, being distributed at Food Not Bombs that I've noticed. You would probably notice more. You'd know more, Stephen. Maybe you, Matt. But usually there was a flyer table back in February, but isn't there anymore, generally. Sometimes. Huh. So, we actually called this number. Gloria, you called this number.
Oh, yeah,
you have a report, maybe, about what happened.
And there's a sort of a bit of controversy between Brent Adams and Keith McHenry. You probably heard it on this show when we talked to Brent. He runs, of course, the Footbridge Services, and good for him for doing that, providing occasionally during the winter day and night shelter, but all through the winter, summer, fall, and spring, storage facilities, shower access, and various other things, which the city and the county simply do not provide for walk-in people, which is what Brent does, which is really commendable. But Brent has been angry with Keith McHenry's Food Not Bombs because he feels that Brent has a different sense of the accessibility of city and county facilities. He thinks things have improved because of the COVID-19 expansion of services for homeless people and expansion of shelters, although Brent is also very upset about the winter shelter not being a happening thing this year, as it wasn't last year either. It's a form of the city ducking its responsibilities, particularly for the elderly and disabled people. And he feels that Food Not Bombs, however, is misrepresenting the other services the city does provide. That is to say, not allowing people the information or not providing the information that might enable them to get a motel room or a shelter room. And there is apparently one number that the city claims and the county claims too, that you can call to get access to these various shelters. And these include the Veterans Hall, the Armory, the Laurel Street, and the motel room situation. And this became a particular sore point for some people when Brent attacked the fact that he feels that Keith is not making this information widely available. But I think he is. But Keith has some doubts as to whether it's actually useful information, because people get essentially into a waiting list situation. Although Brent has said it's just a matter of persistence that he's been able to get people into motel rooms and into shelters, and repeatedly claims the squeaky wheel gets the grease, which if you have the energy to do the squeaking and keep repeating the squeaking or the screaming or the crying loud enough, I guess it's true, but some people don't, and I guess Bob was one of those. And I'm going to interrupt this Huff discussion to read a bit of what Keith McHenry wrote. I guess it was on Tuesday, maybe Monday. Tuesday was, about the death of Bob Reese. It's a memorial he wrote about him. My good friend Bob Reese has been eating with us for years. His belongings dangled from his bike. We became friends during the Freedom Sleepers weekly sleep out at Santa Cruz City Hall in 2015 and 2016. Back then, we would sit on the stone wall outside City Hall and talk. He listened to the BBC on his transmitter radio most evenings. We would discuss the news of the night. Our conversations about world events continued at the post office meals and during the COVID times. He followed news of the war on the people of Yemen and talked with me about the destruction of Libya and the refugee crisis in Europe. We stood together on the Front Street sidewalk outside Woodstock's Pizza watching baseball on their patio TVs. Bob told me most of his time as a well-paid master carpenter with a good union that was his time, and how a family crisis caused him to move to another state where he had to take a non-union job that paid much less. He has never gone into the details of how he ended up on the streets of Santa Cruz. He would thank me after he ate and secret a $5 bill into my hand in appreciation. We commiserated together about the stress we both endured, having lived with a mutual friend. We have much in common. He was hospitalized for heart failure early in the pandemic, and after a short time at rehab, he was discharged back onto the streets. One evening, he pitched a tent in the doorway of a shuttered business of Water Street near 24-Hour Fitness. The police demanded he take it down and leave the area as the officers tugged his survival gear into the street. It wasn't long after that when he came to eat with Food Not Bombs and gave me the news that he had been found on the side of the street passed out from a stroke. He had been on his way to the Emmeline Health Center. Operation Room Key had been announced by Governor Newsom, dumping millions of dollars into Santa Cruz to fund the placement of the unhoused into hotel rooms. The county claimed the most vulnerable people living outside were going to be provided a room at one of the local hotels. Bob was about to turn 70 and his health was fragile, so I called the county every few days seeking a room for him, but was told he didn't qualify. He had to have COVID, they would tell me. After a few months of calling, Bob came to say that he had been given a CPAP machine, but had no place to plug it in. I called the Association of Faith Communities to explain the issue, and within a week, he was granted a space near an outlet at the Methodist Church. And it happened. I get a text on Monday morning saying Bob had passed away. I was stunned. I called the friend who helped Bob get a place at the Methodist Church to get any details. I wanted to know if he had passed away at the shelter. He reported Bob had finally been placed in a hotel, but had not heard the news about his death. As I was helping pack up Food Not Bombs for the day, I mentioned that my friend Bob had passed away. My co-worker asked if Bob had long white hair and a bike. He had come across a white-haired person with a bike surrounded by paramedics on the footbridge near Trader Joe's on Saturday night. They spent nearly 30 minutes doing CPR before he was taken to the ambulance. An EMT told my helper that they thought he had a stroke and crashed into the bridge, cracking his skull. I can only wonder if he would be alive today had he been placed in a hotel as soon as he was discharged from Dominican. He certainly qualified. Bob Reese will be included in the long list of those unhoused that were killed by our system of neglect and hate this year at our memorial service organized by the National Union of the Homeless on the longest night, December 21st, 2020. Our local service will be held that Monday at Laurel and Front Streets in Santa Cruz, starting at 4 p.m. Everyone is welcome. Rest in power, Bob Reese. And before we return to the Huff meeting, a couple of quick messages from Facebook. There is a rally tomorrow, the Friday the 11th at 5 p.m. in support of the Bookshop Santa Cruz workers who are requesting recognition for their union, according to Vicki Winters, posting on Santa Cruz, well, looking at it through Keith McHenry's Santa Cruz Food Not Bombs website. And it looks like, I'm assuming we're talking about a real rally, not just one of these phony Zoom things. And sorry, I don't, I guess it's partially my lack of technological savvy on these issues. But I think in spite of the COVID situation, you need to get out there if you can. You know, if you're not ill or really part of the vulnerable population or worried about that, you know, because of your close connections with people in that situation, don't abandon the need to show up physically. It's an important thing. Otherwise, we leave it to those whose power is in making the rules about who shows up and who essentially can ignore the rules as they wish, as we've seen the politicians do. Lee Myers also writes on Facebook about what sounds like Bob Reese's death. Odd are more people will die from COVID-19 related causes than the coronavirus it accentuates. I already knew one 73-year-old seriously disabled homeless man who died from exposure caused by the Santa Cruz police illegitimately ticketing him for trespassing in a legal space to shelter in place. A few weeks later, he was found dead near a city parking garage where he was found sleeping and hiding. Could have been somebody other than Bob, but I'm guessing it was him. Yeah, perhaps not. December 5th is what this dated. If it wasn't Bob, it was somebody else. And we have, another object lesson. Leave people alone, don't drag them away from their sheltering in places, particularly if they're elderly and disabled. He had apparently fallen down. He was subject to microstrokes and had crippling shooting pains in his legs and hit his head while alone. He died alone with no one to help him. I hold the SCPD responsible for his death. It's R.I.P. Kenny. That's apparently the name of the guy. Apparently another elderly person outside who died of a stroke through not having adequate shelter. And apparently being moved from what shelter he was making by the police, despite Martin versus Boise, the decision, and the COVID-19 shelter-in-place CDC guidelines.
The issue that I have with both the city's listings from Serge Cagnell and Phil Kramer and, I don't know, there's a guy who's covering it at the homeless, the Housing Mutters Center on Coral Street, that, you know, it has all these listings. The question is, how accurate are they? And Brent seems to feel, at least he said this on various interviews, and I can't vouch for it one way or the other, because I haven't taken the time or energy to track it down. You call this one number, it goes you to all the shelter services, and they can then direct you to either the Yum Yum COVID Is Yours group shelter services, which may be, you know, spawning a whole new COVID scene as we go through winter and the thing outbreaks more, if it does.
Bed bugs too.
Say it again?
Bed bugs too.
Yeah. And bed bugs?
They don't assign a single bed pan or bed mattress thing to anyone. They reshuffle them every day.
Say that again, Steve.
So with the bed mats, they don't actually, like, in some shelters, and what they used to do is you would have your bed mat, and it was registered, like, assigned to you. Now they just every night reshuffle them. They don't wash them. They throw them in a truck, and then they just give them back. So it's basically just spreading bed bugs and potentially COVID. The way the shelters
them.
Operate.
They don't keep them or do anything?
No, they just keep them all together in a pile, and every night just give a random one out to each person.
Are you referencing all the shelters, or
Not sure which one. I know that I think it might be just two of them. I'm going off of what Brent and one other of the houseless people, or actually two of the houseless people that I've seen at the services center brought up.
What shelters are they?
I believe it's the Vets Hall and Salvation Army. But
so the armory may be different?
Might be different. But yeah, and that number is, it's called the County Shelter Response Line, but I actually went, they put two numbers recently on the sweeps. When they do the sweeps, they put out those notices to leave and vacate. They just did one to Felker Camp last week with a deadline of last Monday, the one earlier this week. And they put two numbers on there. One of the numbers is this woman, Chris Youngren, who's in that white trailer behind the county building next to the Freedom Camp. And I went and spoke with her personally and kind of introduced myself, and we had a conversation. And the gist I got from her is that they're like 3 months backed up. All shelters are pretty much 3 months backed up. The only option to probably get in a bed is to go down to Coral during 5:15 to 6-something window to try to do that, like, on a nightly service. But even then, you have to, like, stay in a specific area over and over, and it usually is 2 or 3 days, if not longer, to actually get into a bed. So it's a really overly packed and convoluted and, like, slowed out process. It's not easy to just get in bed.
So Lundgren says that, unlike in the past, Youngren says that in the past, the Coral Street complex moved, at least the Paul Lee Loft, which used to have drop-in, that was, I don't know, 10 years ago, it moved into program stuff where you have to sign up, go ID card, go through, but it's not a night-to-night thing generally. And that's changed again, so you can have night-to-night access there sometimes.
There is the drop-in program. I don't know if it's a new drop-in program or if it's like a shadow of the old one. But it does still exist, but it's very, very backed up, and you have to stay in like a certain waiting staging area, and you have to keep showing up every day into that area. Otherwise, you will lose your spot. So you can't just like show up that night, be turned down, and then, you know, go out on the streets, find somewhere to camp, come back the next day or the next day after, and be able to just find the spot. You have to consistently show up at the spot, and it's a couple days behind, usually backed up.
Steve, were you here last year, by the way? I interrupted you.
I was here last year, but I was not in like the scene or the activist circuit. I was homeless on my own, but I wasn't in the camps or anywhere.
Anyone have any recollection, because I don't, of whether there was winter armory shelter last year? I think Brent and I were both saying there wasn't, but I don't
there
have
was,
a clear memory.
Shelter at over at Laurel Street, there was Salvation Army shelter.
Yeah.
There's 64 people on a bad night. You had to sleep like an inch and a half from total strangers. sometimes I was sleeping, the mattresses were touching, but at least I knew the people and they were together with it. Because it's really scary sleeping around people you do not know. Yeah. They're drinking vodka. Who knows what they're going to do next. There's a lot of meth addicts over there, but at least it was a place to be and it was warm and we got food. Hot chocolate and coffee.
Right. So the armory hasn't been available for quite a while, and winter shelter... I guess winter shelter was drop-in last year to some extent. I mean, you could line up at the parking lot, which then became the Food Not Bombs COVID, first Food Not Bombs COVID place, the first Food Not Bombs meal service, and you could presumably line up to get in there. That's my recollection now. And they take you to Laurel Street, and that's what would happen.
But Laurel Street was not the winter shelter in the way that an independent winter shelter was established in prior years. Laurel Street was a year-round kind of shelter that did not provide extra facility in the winter, which many of us felt was necessary because of weather conditions and the vulnerability of people who are outside.
Yeah, there were buses for a while. The buses didn't quite last as long as the shelters.
So that's what this is all about. So I'm going to go through this agenda. But before I do, does anybody have anything they want to add to it? Any questions?
I want to add a good news section. I think we should have focus on, like, every week we come up with different stuff that we want to say that we heard during the week that was positive.
And so Huff will presumably now have a positive section on its agenda for all of you who think we're just a bunch of sorry gloom heads. And check it out every Wednesday at 11 o'clock at the Sub Rosa Courtyard. We're likely to be there. So for those of you who like to follow Santa Cruz Indie Media, that's indiebay.org/Santa Cruz, I've posted a new story about, it has the criminal record of Deb Elston, by the which I mean the police record of harassing homeless people with citations, although I wasn't able to get the information. They redacted it as far as finding out who these particular people who got tickets were. They're not supposed to do that, but they choose to do it anyway. But you can see, get an idea of the breadth, scope, and determination of Deb Elston, the volunteer police SCPD woman who is also next door moderator and Santa Cruz Neighbors organizer, and a person who has been targeted by those trying to, counter-target her for her own targeting of homeless people in their vehicles at night. A protest was taken to her house. You've heard that in past shows. So if you want to get more information, you can go online and check out that particular story, which is titled Volunteer SCPD Homeless Harasser Deb Elston's Ticketing Record. And you can also get a listing of all the other numbers and names of her volunteer crew of, or perhaps we'll call it Andy Mills' crew. I don't know how much authority she, Deb Elston, has over these people. So now let's take another quick listen at a segment from the Kim Brown's Burn It Down, discussing and interviewing a socialist council member up in Seattle and what happened with police defunding up there.
All right. Well, if you weren't convinced that the police need to be defunded after listening to the story there of Andres Guardado, Seattle has something to tell you. Okay. There has been development. And mind you guys, now we know that despite the fact that people have been out in the streets calling for defunding the police, there is a lot of resistance, not only politically, but by police themselves, which wield a lot of political power in a lot of these cities and towns in which all of us live. The city of Tampa, Florida, When proposed with cuts to the police department, the mayor and the city council said, no, we don't think that that stands a chance of happening. Los Angeles actually has agreed to a small cut in defunding the police by only 5%. But Seattle has taken an extraordinary step with announcing, by a recent vote by the Seattle City Council, that they intend to cut the funding of the police department by 20%. Which to a lot of people sounds like a big deal, but to many activists in any end, including people that actually live in Seattle, that's not a big enough cut. And right now we are joined with Seattle City Council person, Shama Sawant. Shama has spent, she's not a career politician. She is an activist with the Socialist Alternative and a rank and file member of the Teachers Union. Shama has also won 3 elections despite big business and the Democratic Party opposition, and has helped win working class victories like the $15 an hour minimum wage and the Amazon tax on big business to fund affordable housing and the Green New Deal. We are very, very honored to be joined today with Councilperson Sawant joining us today from Seattle. Thank you so much for making some time today for us, Councilwoman. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, Kim.
Okay, so when I read the story that broke at the end of November that the Seattle City Council had agreed to this 20% cut or voted on this 20% cut to police, I almost pooped my pants because, you know, in the city, in area in which I live, Washington, D.C. and Baltimore, Maryland, 2 areas where the police get a gross amount of money and places that not only the police budgets have been increasing pretty much every year for maybe the past 20 or 30 years. If you told activists in Baltimore, Maryland, that the police budget was going to get cut by 20%, they would dance a jig. But when I read that you voted against this because it didn't go far enough, I was actually very impressed. I'm like, you know what? I respect that. Talk to me about, number one, what the city council did, and tell me why you voted against it.
Thank you for that very important question. I think the events in Seattle have lessons in both directions. One, why we won some of the things we won in the wake of the Justice for George Floyd movement, and why didn't our movement win the things that we were fighting for. I think both sides contain extremely rich lessons for us to go forward with. And just to clarify at the very outset, I did not vote against the progressive amendments to the proposed budget from the mayor. I voted against the budget as a whole, the package. And this is my 7th year on the city council. I am the lone socialist. All the 8 council members, the other 8 council members are part of the Democratic establishment. And every year I have voted, when we vote on the budget, I have not only voted for, but using my office have built the People's Budget Movement to fight for and win historic amendments through the budget to go in a progressive direction. But I've always voted against the budget as a package. That is the vote you're talking about, which is not the vote just in the reductions of the police budget, but on the budget as a whole of the city. And the reason I've voted against it every year is that the budget, at the end of the day, you know, all year, these Democratic Party politicians make promises after promises. But what really shows their commitment, it's the dollars on the table. And so in that sense, the budget of a city or a state or the federal budget is a moral document. And at the end of the day, this budget, unfortunately, this year again, especially in the context of COVID and the recession, is an austerity budget. Believe it or not, in this supposedly progressive city, these 8 Democratic council members approved a budget that cuts nearly $200 million in community services and in affordable housing. You know, in community services, including bus hours that our most marginalized communities and essential workers rely on. That is what I voted against. And as far as what we won on the police budget, I think it's important to note that if you leave out the shifting of certain services like parking enforcement and 911 phone calls from the police department, the actual reduction in the police budget is less than 8% of the budget, which every dollar that we have succeeded in reducing in the police budget should absolutely be recognized as a victory of a very determined movement of tens of thousands of ordinary people in Seattle. But at the same time, we have to be sober and understand that in the at the peak of the Justice for George Floyd protests, where tens of millions of people were on the streets across America, including tens of thousands in Seattle, at the height of that moment movement, there was real pressure on the Democratic establishment to make promises. We had many of these Latina council members that serve alongside me who voted for a racist police contract just 2 years ago, this year during the George Floyd protests, in tears, asking for the movement's forgiveness and saying they were going to do the right thing. They were going to defund the bloated police budget by at least 50% and really push for police accountability. But the moment the street heat declined, by the time it was October and November, all those promises, you know, wafted into thin air. And at the end of the day, it was just my lone socialist council office that stood steadfastly with the movement, demanding a 50% defund, demanding that the city council not pass an austerity budget, which we know disproportionately hits communities of color, but as a whole, is detrimental to working people as a whole. In the middle of this COVID, we are demanding that the bloated police budget should be reduced. And at the same time, we need an elected civilian oversight board with real powers of the police, you know, a board that has the right to hire and fire police officers, subpoena police officers. By the way, these Democrats voted against that proposal from my office as well. So my point is that we should recognize all the victories we've won. Each and every one of them has come because we built a fighting movement. And what we didn't win, we need to build a fighting movement to win.
Thank you very much, Councilperson, for making that important distinction that you voted against the budget as a whole and not necessarily against the police cuts. But, I mean, this has been a long time coming. And you said this year with the movement for Black Lives, with the protests about the murder of George Floyd, really being the catalyst to not only energize the people in the streets, but hopefully the politicians who are in positions of power to actually make decisions about that. And earlier this year, the African-American woman who was the police chief for the city of Seattle, Carmen Best, she resigned abruptly after the mere suggestion of cutting the Seattle police budget. I think she resigned only after the threat of $4 million being cut from the budget. I'm curious, what has been the response from police, from their unions or the organizations that, you know, represent the police? Are they mature? Are they handling this news about their budget going down in any way? Are they handling it well? Or are they perhaps making threats of labor shortages, of sick outs, something similar that we saw happen in Minneapolis after the uprisings there, where we saw a lot of police just flat out refuse to do their job out of protest of even the mere mention, the proposal, the suggestion of their budgets being cut? How have they been handling this news in Seattle?
There's no question that this police department in Seattle as a whole, and especially the Police Officers Guild, which is the supposed union that represents the police force. And I say supposed because I speak at myself as a rank and file member of the local teachers union. And as somebody who has absolutely fought for labor rights and the rights of workers to unionize. But here, there's a problem here. You know, in the labor movement, we have a saying that the labor movement really should live by, and it really comes down to the rich history of the labor, courageous history of the labor movement was built on the adage that an injury to one is an injury to all. And if you put that front and center as the sort of the theme, the framework for building a strong labor movement, then you can see that a police department or a police officers guild that carries out violence, especially racist attacks against ordinary people, the brutal violence of chemical weapons against peaceful protests, that is not something that the labor movement can stand with. And so that is why I'm really proud of my fellow rank and file workers in the Martin Luther King County Labor Council, which is the local AFL-CIO organization, which voted in a majority to expel the Police Officers Guild from our labor council, because there's no room for this kind of attack on any workers. We need actually what we need is tremendous solidarity amongst the working class of all races, because we are all feeling the onslaught from the billionaire class who are continuing to profiteer during this pandemic, and the brunt of the recession and the healthcare crisis is being placed on the shoulders of working people. So by supporting a police officer's guild that is carrying out racist violence, that's no basis for building a united labor movement. And that is why we took that step. And as far as the police chief Carmen Best is concerned, not only is it true what you just said, Kim, but she specifically resigned when the city council took up a proposal from my office and the People's Budget Movement in the summer, which was a proposal to limit the salaries of many of the executives in the police department. And many of them, believe it or not, had been making more than all the 50 governors in the United States of America. So they're making just completely out of this world salaries. And for what? With no accountability, with 29 community members having been killed at the hands of the police since 2011, and not one single police officer being indicted as a result of that. And so it's quite shameful that Carmen Best decided to resign in that context, when it came to her own salary, which even after the proposed cuts, they were very moderate cuts. Even after the proposed cuts, she was going to be one of the most highly paid executives and certainly making, like tens of thousands of dollars more than ordinary workers in Seattle. And so it really.
And that's about it for this segment. You can find the rest of this Seattle Rep's discussion, and there's another 20 minutes of it, on the Kim Brown's Burn It Down on YouTube. I encourage you to go and check it out if you find this topic of interest. And now we're going to hear from J.C. Orton, who is a Berkeley street spirit kind of master distributor. He's sort of the central person who makes sure that the newspaper sold by homeless folks on the street gets out. It's a source of income for about 100 people up there who are street vendors, or at least it was in the last couple of years. I'm not sure what the COVID crisis has done to the numbers, but that's what we're going to hear now, and that is what we're going to kind of sign off with, because I'm up against a time crunch. But this is going to be a leisurely interview, but I'm going to run anyway to post this because that's what I got to do. Thanks for listening. Get back at you on Sunday if you listen into the 9:30 show, or perhaps you can hear us on the archives at huffsantacruz.org.